particularly with stroke and minority groups, they have a higher risk factor for stroke purely because they are predisposed in terms of genetics. When you look at black people, which is what my work focuses on, black Africans, and also this group tends to have higher level of diabetes, obesity, and hypertension. And hypertension is the number one risk factor for stroke. And it's normally undetectable in people unless they go to their GP and they get checked out. So that's the main reason why they have higher stroke incidences, because of their comorbidity factors.
Does this also have something to do with diet and low socioeconomic status?
In certain areas of England, yes. In our study, we focused in the East End of London. And the borough we focused on was Newham. And Newham is ranked in the top six for most deprived areas in England. So, yes, we have a lot of it. It is closely linked to socioeconomic status, diet, health literacy, and everything else, really.
So your most recent study looked at the coping mechanisms of African Caribbean women post-stroke. Why this group in particular?
Well, it's got something to do with, I'm originally from the Caribbean, so I have a close affinity to the Caribbean. But what I've also realised is that migrant groups in the UK, particularly in London, don't have a voice when it comes to their health. And culture really informs people's perception of their health. So that's why I chose that group. It's to give a voice to a community that I belong to and I come from, and to sort of see how best we could improve people's health.
So generally, what happens to an individual after they've had a stroke?
So in the UK, we have a stroke pathway program. So the patient would be admitted, or the individual, through the A&E department. They'd have been scanned, thrombolyzed if needed, taken to a hyperacute stroke unit, go through the processes there, may have to end up on a rehabilitation ward, and eventually they could be discharged. So they could be discharged within 3 or 4 days of their admission, depending on the type of stroke they had, or 3 or 4 months. But then they go back home into the community, and most times this is where the problem happens, because the service is no longer there, and the individual has to begin to reshape their lives and work with their families quite closely.
How are the service provisions in these low socioeconomic areas?
It's good to an extent. Things could always be better, because we always find ways of, you know, wanting to improve it. But the Stroke Association in the UK have a wonderful system where we have called stroke navigators. So a stroke navigator liaises with the hospital when the individual is about to be discharged, and they would visit them in their home. And they're basically their role, as it says, navigator. They help navigate the individual through the systems in terms of, you probably need to apply for benefits. You probably need to have a carer come in to help you. And they help with those things. So it's quite good in that respect once it's up and working.
And, of course, this is all covered under the NHS in the UK.
That's right, yeah.
So when these women get home, what happens to them?
So what you tend to find, and that we have found, is that the families take on the responsibility of care. And in one of our last studies looking at stroke carers, one of the things we found is that although someone was assigned to a family, a carer, the family would get up early in the morning, like from 4 o'clock, and do everything before the carer came, because it was very much their responsibility. So even though a carer is provided, they're sort of locked out because of the family's belief that it's their responsibility. So families take on, in ethnic minority groups, that is, the majority of the care needs. In our study, initial study in Newham, when we asked the question, where does most of your care come from, compared to the white population that answered that question, you know, most of them were from the hospital services or my GP or a carer. The black and Asian population said it came from within the home. And then we asked the sub-question, was that professional or non-professional care? And it was always non-professional care. So we saw a huge difference there.
Do you think that has to do with the emphasis placed on families in white communities compared to black and Asian communities?
That could be one of the reasons, but also in black and Asian families, there's an extended family. So you kind of really don't, you know, 2 or 3 generations would live under the same roof, whereas in a white family, you wouldn't have that. So that's why you may have the reliance on outside care groups. Whereas if it was an older person who had the stroke, you know, their children, their grandchildren, well, everybody else will be around, and that's where they get the support from within the family.
For the individuals that the carers are caring for, are the individuals receptive to what the carers are doing?
The individuals are receptive. Our last study, when we looked at carers, informal carers, experience, is that there seems to be emphasis on what they like, and they think a carer wouldn't be able to do that. So that's where we need to bridge the gap and do the cultural sensitive training. So, for example, African women talked about, my mother doesn't need to have a wash. She needs to have a proper shower. And the word proper comes up, or a full shower. And you think, okay, there's something around personal hygiene and this particular group that we need to pay attention to. So I'm not sure if it's the same here, but carers are very time limited because they go in for 20, 30 minutes. They may not be able to do a shower in 20, 30 minutes and everything else. So we have to look at how we build that into the system and how we can work as a partnership.
You mentioned also the professional and non-professional care. Obviously, families are providing that non-professional care. Is that a problem because it may not be as well informed?
There's potential for it to be a problem, but I think what we need to do, again, is look at how we work with families. So most of the families, and I think this comes back to before with stroke care and before stroke discharge, we should actually have meetings with families, because it's, as one participant said to me, it's not like you're going in for a hip operation and you know what's going to happen. It just happens, a stroke. It's sudden. You're not prepared for it. So it's the same thing. I think we need to look at, while the individual is in hospital, how we get the family into a support system and say, this is what to expect and this is what to do. In one of my studies, I had a wife caring for her husband who was diabetic and had onset dementia. And she said when he woke up in the morning, she wasn't sure if he was confused from the dementia or he had low blood sugar. And she was making clinical decisions on whether to give him breath and jam or insulin. It's quite complex in that sense. And it's a lot of responsibility. So I think that's why we need to have a program set up where we actually support the families before discharge.
Religion was also a big theme in this study that you did. It helped the participants cope. Are health professionals aware of just how important religion is to African Caribbean women?
I don't think health professionals are that aware of the importance of religion, because we very much use a medical model of some sort. It may not be a full biomedical model, but we use a medical model where we really see cause and how we treat the cause rather than, you know, looking at the psychosocial aspects of illness and disease. And in our study, what we found is that the women we interviewed constructed their disease around a social awareness. It wasn't that it was a biological cause. Everything they did, their illness was socially constructed. So, for example, one participant said, I've never been unfaithful to my husband. I don't drink alcohol. Why would God punish me with a stroke?
Because that was the next study you looked at, was the what migrant women actually think the factors are that causes this disease.
Yeah, so they really and truly believe, they don't believe in, they believe there's a biological cause to some extent, but their health literacy isn't that great around that area. So people did say things like, you know, I've reduced the salt in my diet, or I wasn't obese at the time, or I was never diabetic. So those were the younger women in the study. And I say younger, this is the ones who were like 45 to 55. We had women in our study as young as 39 who have had a stroke. So they the younger ones were aware. The older women certainly weren't aware. So they looked at religion and spirituality as a cause for their illness, and they shaped their illness around that. So one participant said it's witchcraft. Someone said was jealous of her and, you know, posted witchcraft upon her. That's why she got her stroke. And she, to this day, that is what she believes.
Do we need to have a conversation with the older women then about what causes stroke?
So we do. So we have stroke programs that run in the community, support community groups, particularly in East London. There's some great groups going on there. And that's what we are doing. We are getting people out and organizing that, you know, they come in and we do day center workshops and so forth. So we are getting there with that.